When you think of the word cult, some things probably come to mind. A zealous leader who thinks himself God or descended from God, hoarding everyone's money and land, eventually saying he needs all of the women to become his wives. But what you probably don't think of is hijacking a medieval European city in order to wait for the rapture, all while fighting off approaching armies, several public executions and cases of people being tortured to death, and having your leaders... funny parts, nailed to the door of the city itself. But believe it or not, everything I just said is what we're going to be talking about today. And that is because today, we are talking about the Munster Rebellion. Over on the second channel, Wendigang, I have several researchers who are putting together information on certain video topics. And one of them, Vincent, put together the information on today's story. And as soon as I read it, I said, oh no, 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 that one's coming with me. Because I just felt like I wasn't doing the story justice unless I turned it into an incoherent ramble over on this channel. So if you're ready to hear about how a niche religious movement managed to take over a city, had their leader die a couple times, and ended with a lot of people dying in really terrible ways, then stick around after the ad as we talk about the Munster Rebellion. But you know what's a really good way to not die? Eating healthy. But eating healthy can be hard when the food's expensive, inconvenient, and just doesn't taste good. But now, all of those problems are solved thanks to today's sponsor, Factor. Factor makes meeting your nutrition goals easier than ever by delivering fresh, never frozen, dietitian-approved meals right to your doorstep. Not only are they tasty and healthy, but they're also super easy to make. Every week, you'll get to choose from a menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Factor also has more than 60 add-ons every week, so you can add breakfasts, lunch on the go, smoothies, snacks, or whatever you're feeling. It lets you skip the stress of grocery stores, and you can get a well-rounded meal in one easy step. Factor is also really flexible. You can have as few or as many orders delivered per week as you like, and if you're ever out of town or something, you can simply skip a week with no hassle. I really have no idea what they do to make food you put in a microwave taste that good. I've talked before in these ads about how my wife will constantly steal the ones that I'm looking forward to, and at this point, I'm pretty much looking forward to all of them. You can also do Gourmet Plus meals, which are your fancy options for the week, like filet mignon or maybe something with truffle butter. And over this last week, the Gourmet Plus option we got was the Surf and Surf, which is salmon and shrimp. And my wife said I could have it because she swore there was no way salmon and shrimp would taste good in the microwave. And I, again, do not know what they're doing to their food there, but it was great. So if you're looking for an affordable way to eat healthy and not hate your life while you're doing it, then there's never been a better time to get in on this offer. That's because right now, if you head to factor75.com or click the link below and use code 50WENDIGOON, you can get 50% off plus free shipping on your first Factor box. That is right, code 50WENDIGOON at factor75.com to get half off plus free shipping on your first Factor box to get in on this incredible offer today. Thank you all for watching the ad, and thank you to Factor for sponsoring the channel. Their link will be in the description, and we are now back to the video. We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. Now, to understand how this story can exist, you need to understand a little bit about European politics in the 16th century. More specifically, the Holy Roman Empire. On paper, the Holy Roman Empire is one of the longest existing empires in humanity's history. It began in the year 800 and didn't officially end until 1806, meaning it existed for 1,006 years. But to truly call it an empire, at least to many historians, is a bit of a stretch. See, it wasn't so much one unified group of people as much as it was a sort of confederacy between different lords and kings and villages. Several different houses or families could go to war with each other within the empire, but as long as both of them still respected the Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire's influence, they could pretty much get away with what they wanted. In other words, it was more of a loose conglomeration of individual groups rather than a unified empire. With that loose connection being a reverence for the Catholic Church. Or, as the old joke goes, at least to some, the Holy Roman Empire was none of those things. For most of its life, the Holy Roman Empire comprised most of the area that is now Central Europe. And for the first several hundred years of the empire's existence, while some people within the empire may have problems with each other, they were pretty much all reverent of the Catholic Church. That was until 1517, when someone by the name of Martin Luther decided he had a problem with that. After he nailed his 95 theses, or problems he had with the Catholic Church, to the door of the church in Wittenberg, which lies in an area that is now Germany, several Christians began to separate from the Catholic Church, and those who did or protested the Catholic Church became the first Protestants. And one of these groups that began to surface around 1525 was a group known as the Anabaptists. Anabaptists, or in other words, anti-Baptist, diverged from even Martin Luther and the Protestant beliefs. The most prominent of their beliefs, and the one that their namesake comes from, was a rejection of the idea of infant baptism. See, within the Catholic Church, as well as Martin Luther and a lot of his early followers, and even Protestant denominations to this day, infants are baptized in order to affirm their salvation from a young age. Whereas the Anabaptists believed in something known as believer's baptism, the belief that infants do not need to be baptized as they are not yet aware of sin and do not yet have the capability to believe in God, and that baptism should wait until that individual is old enough to comprehend and believe in God. Now, this idea of believer's baptism has worked its way, at least to my knowledge, into the majority of Protestant religions today. But at the time, saying that infants shouldn't be baptized, something that was vehemently pressed by the Catholic Church for over a millennia, was a really big deal. Now, while this might not sound like a lot to get in a fuss over today, you've got to understand the context historically. While it may be commonplace now to hear things like the age of accountability, or effectively the idea that young children and infants are brought up to heaven when they die because they're not yet at a point to understand their sin. Or you'll also hear some Christian branches say things like, salvation is a personal matter rather than a matter through the church. While now it's more common for people to read the Bible or religious text and come to their own conclusions, you've got to understand that literacy was not common at all in the Middle Ages. The only interaction with Christianity most people would have was when the Bible was read to them by a Catholic priest. So to say that that guy's wrong and the church he's in is wrong because of their beliefs, that's a pretty heavy statement. Not to mention the insane rate that children and babies would die during this time period. Stillbirths and infant death were super common, as was women dying in childbirth. So if the Anabaptists were right about infant baptism not being required, that's really cool and all, but if they're wrong, that's a lot of souls going to hell, at least as the church saw it. And that's just as it related to baptism. The Anabaptists also found a lot of other ways to make the church very mad. One of the other reasons Anabaptists did not like the church was because of the power structure. They did not like the idea of someone being put in a place of power over someone else, so several of them would advocate for an agorist lifestyle free of a power structure. This includes a communal ownership of goods and land rather than exchanging money, rejecting participation in secular government, so in other words, not adhering to lords or kings or queens, and the ethics of pacifism, which goes in stark contrast to the philosophy of most lords and rulers of the time, which is build up an army and just throw them at people you don't like. That is also foreshadowing for, like, I don't know, probably 30, 40 minutes from now. I'm hesitant to put any modern political labels on it just because the movement was so different than most of what's seen in culture today, but it wouldn't be entirely wrong to call it a sort of theological socialism. And as you can imagine, from religious beliefs to government rule, the Anabaptist and the Catholic Church butted heads a lot. There was also a lot of rebellion against the ruling classes in Germany that wasn't even explicitly religious. At the same time the Anabaptists showed up, the German Peasants' War took place, which is as it sounds when a bunch of peasant class people in what is now Germany banded together and started to fight against rulers in the region. It got stomped out in a year and a lot of people died, but it goes to show that a lot of people were pretty upset with how things were being ran. So with that setting in mind, we can start to talk about our story. But our story doesn't begin in Münster. It actually begins in Strasbourg. See, amongst all of this turmoil, there were several people who were taking the newfound idea that maybe the Catholic Church isn't right about everything all the time, and they were getting creative with it. Several people were coming up with their own interpretation of scriptures that, more often than not, glorified their own divinity. A side note within Christianity that has sadly become hard to shake. One of these people was a man named Melchior Hoffmann, who made his way to Strasbourg around 1530. Hoffmann declared that he was one of the two witnesses mentioned in the book of Revelation. Short version, for those of you who don't want to hear me ramble about the Bible for 2 hours for some reason. Two witnesses are said to be on earth shortly before Jesus' return, who are then killed and then resurrected up to heaven in the final days. In other words, Hoffmann effectively declared himself one of God's final prophets. So Hoffmann began prophesying and said that Jesus would return to earth in 1534 and create his new Jerusalem, not in the actual Jerusalem, but instead here in Strasbourg. He managed to amass several hundred followers, but as soon as the authorities of the city, who mind you are a part of the Catholic Church, when they got word of it, they arrested him. Now, it wasn't outside of the Catholic Church's normal operations to execute anyone they saw as Anabaptist or heretics, but they were afraid, given the fact this guy is saying that he is one of the two witnesses of Revelation and he has a bunch of followers, and if they kill him, his followers will probably make him into a martyr, especially considering that's part of the prophecy for the two witnesses. So rather than killing him and giving him what he wants, they just locked him up in a tower. And Hoffman would actually live out the rest of his life, what few years of it were left, within that tower. Now, this didn't do what the authorities wanted it to do. His followers didn't immediately disband, they just changed their ideas. See, Hoffman had said that Jesus would return in Strasbourg in 1534. And when 1534 came, the guy got arrested, and spoilers, Jesus didn't come back, probably. So several of them still believed in Hoffman and just said maybe he got the date and the city wrong. So now there were several hundred people in the city who believed they need to find a new Jerusalem, they just didn't know where yet. And it is now that our story takes us to Münster. Münster lied just north of Strasbourg and was built as your stereotypical medieval city. It had a large church in the middle, surrounded by several houses and marketplaces. It had a large wall surrounding the city, and outside of that wall is where the farmers and resources for food were located. Well, at the time of our story, it wasn't necessarily medieval. It had modern implements like a printing press. The feudal layout of the city will matter to the story. Inside of Münster, there was a man named Bernard Rothman. Rothman was a former Catholic priest who left the church after the Protestant movement began. However, Rothman seemed to be following the Anabaptist movement, rejecting infant baptism, believing in equality of ownership and land, and rejecting hierarchies like the Catholic Church or lords. As a matter of fact, he took it a step farther and even said that any of the gentry or noble class were sinful for being within nobility. The city of Münster had a city council, which was a brand new invention at the time. See, after the peasant revolt a few years prior, a lot of the lords and kings caved in and started to give people small governments within cities in order to make some decisions for themselves. So these city council members, who only existed because of the aforementioned peasant revolt, started to hear Rothman say things like, "Lords and kings are bad," and started to fall on his side. So much so that after the Catholic Church ordered him to stop preaching, the city of Münster not only allowed him to continue preaching, but assigned him a bodyguard during his sermons. One of Rothman's allies within the city council was a man named Bernard Nipperdoling. Nipperdoling, sure. Since both he and Rothman's first names are Bernard, I guess I've got to keep calling him that. Nipperdoling was a very powerful cloth merchant within northern Germany. And because of that, he was able to shield Rothman from a lot of the Catholic Church's attempts to silence him. Nipperdoling even had access to the town's printing press. So as Rothman would preach, his sermons would be transcribed and Nipperdoling would have them printed and distributed across Germany. And in some of these leaflets, we can see quotes that show how radical his ideas were compared to the common ideas of the time. Like, quote, "The idea of owning anything, or of thinking in terms of this is mine and that is yours, was evil. God had made all things in common, as today we can still enjoy air, fire, rain, and the sun." And while the Catholic Church certainly scoffed at this, in an era that again just had a war known as the Peasants' War, a lot of the common people took solace in the idea of not only equality, but financial non-existence. So several people who felt disillusioned by their local governments, again the poor and the needy for the most part, began to flock to Münster as a sort of safe haven. And one of these groups, who came across a leaflet of Rothman's printed sermon and decided to make the pilgrimage to Münster, was the group that Hoffman had left behind in Strasbourg after he was arrested and thrown in a tower. Not long after Hoffman got arrested, the group was taken over by a man named Hon Mathis. Right after Hoffman got arrested for saying that he was one of the two witnesses from the Book of Revelation, Mathis quickly stepped in and said that he was the other one of the two witnesses from the Book of Revelation. And I mean, to be fair to Hoffman's followers, if your leader's like, "I am one of the two witnesses," and then the government arrests him, and then one of his second in command step forward and is like, "I am one of the other two witnesses," I mean, you could see how that tracks. After Mathis heard of what was going on in Munster, he says that Hoffman was right about everything regarding a new Jerusalem and Jesus coming back to Earth, but it wouldn't happen in Strasbourg, it would instead happen in Munster. When Mathis stepped in to take charge of this group, his second in command was a young man named Han van Leeden. Is that not insane that in Munster we had two people named Bernard at the center of the story, and now out of the Strasbourg group we have two people named Han as the center of the story? I guess both of those names were probably super common in Germany, but still it's annoying. What's funny is both Mathis and van Leeden had no religious experience. At least with figures like Bernard Rothman, you know, he was a former priest. If anyone knows about the Bible and could hypothetically make, like, changes to their interpretation of it, it could be that guy. But Mathis was formerly a baker, and van Leeden was formerly a tailor. But what they lacked in knowledge, they made up for in charisma. Mathis would present himself as stoic and a point of authority, and his second-in-command, van Leeden, would present himself as vibrant and theatrical, both of which were fully convinced that God was coming back soon, and Munster was the place that was going to happen. So Mathis and van Leeden send four followers to Munster to assess the city. And if there was ever a city for a group of people who believe they're following the two witnesses of Revelation, one of which is locked up, it was Munster. To give you an idea of how much Munster changed in a short amount of time, the ruler of the city was Prince Bishop Franz von Waldeck. Again, the Holy Roman Empire was ran by the Catholic Church, so several of the landowners were bishops that were given a prince status and were set to rule over several cities within the empire. So while Waldeck was the ruler of Munster, he didn't actually live there as he was the ruler over several cities and towns. So the bishop wasn't there, and after the large migration of people who followed Rothman's teachings, most of the Catholic hierarchy within the city had been ran out. And what was previously known as a city of merchant shops and trade had now become a city where several people were practicing communal living. Not to mention that since Rothman was a former priest, when he became Anabaptist, several Catholic church members, like nuns, followed him. So it's a city that doesn't have a bishop, what Catholic influence that's there for the most part has converted, and they're already practicing the kind of living that you were trying to implement. So in early 1534, Mathis and van Leeden take their people to the city of Munster. On February the 8th, van Leeden, again the theatrical second in command of this whole ordeal, ran through the streets of Munster screaming that the end was nigh and people need to repent or be doomed to hellfire. This caused several people to break into hysteria, according to several accounts, none specifically who had followed after Rothman, with stories of people wailing in the streets and seeing visions of the coming revelation and end times that would fall on the Holy Roman Empire. See, while Rothman and the Anabaptists had a large presence and were certainly gaining ground within Munster, Munster was a large city, so there were still pockets of Lutherans or Catholics that were living in a kind of tense harmony, at least until van Leeden showed up and started screaming about the end times. After van Leeden's impromptu sermon, several Anabaptists seized the town hall. All of the new Anabaptists were declared citizens of Munster, and several people, realizing that this was getting tense, began to flee. Before this event, Munster still had a Lutheran majority, but after it, Anabaptists seemed to be on the rise. But things really got intense when Mathis started to take control. See, while Mathis and Rothman may have agreed theologically or on their opinions of communal living, where they disagreed was in their tactics. Rothman had been in Munster for a while, and while he had left the church, he was preaching sermons, having them printed and dispersed, and was trying to win people over with his message. Mathis was trying to win people over with extreme violence. To give you an idea for what this guy looked like too, he would always wear long black robes and had a long black beard. Effectively, think of a 16th century version of Rasputin. On February the 25th, while Mathis was giving a sermon in a local marketplace, he said that it was time for Munster to be cleansed of the unrighteous. He claimed that he not only spoke with, but that he spoke for God, and that God said anyone who did not fully believe in the Anabaptists or in the New Jerusalem that would soon take place, so in other words, Papist, Lutherans, anyone that is an Anabaptist, would be, on the orders of God, executed. Nipperdoling, again the cloth merchant who was running the printing press, while agreeing with Mathis's Anabaptist belief, believed that if they started executing people, that's going to look really bad and prompt a response from the Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire's armies. So at Nipperdoling's request, Mathis now says that anyone who will not convert to this new belief will be cast out of the city, and those who remain will be forcibly rebaptized. So in other words, leave your home, business, and everything that you know, which is easier said than done in 1534, or let us dunk you in water and you become a part of our new religion. And on February 27th, the expulsion began. Armed men roamed the city, looking for the godless, hoarding them to the gates of the city and casting them out into the cold winter countryside. It didn't matter if they were young, sick, old, pregnant. People were beaten, their possessions stolen, and they were thrown out into the cold snow. For 3 days, this process continued, and those who didn't want to risk it against the elements in the no man's land that was the open country of the Holy Roman Empire were brought to the town square and underwent mandatory baptism. So now, Mathis and Van Leeden had what they wanted, an entire city under their control. The first thing they did was declare any of the belongings of the unrighteous, or the people who just got cast out, now belong to them. So all of the furniture, clothes, food, and coins from the people that had just been cast out were brought to a collection in the middle of the city. Contract and account books were burned, ensuring that no man owed another any debts. Well, this lasted for like 3 days, and then Mathis decided that's not good enough. Not only are we going to collect all of the belongings of the people we kicked out, but let's collect all the belongings of the people we didn't kick out. Now, it's important to point out that, yes, while Rothman, before Mathis showed up, was not as violent or direct as Mathis was, throughout all of Mathis's actions, Rothman was right at his side, continuing his sermons as always. Right after this new decree, Rothman preached, "Brothers and sisters, it is completely God's will that we bring our money, silver, and gold together. One person should have just as much as another." Which this sermon of care and equality kind of rings hollow when previous citizens of the town are freezing to death outside of the city's walls. Mathis assigned 7 deacons to take the collected wealth and reassign it to people according to their needs. Something, something from each according to his ability, something, something to each according to something. As you can imagine, there was immediately pushback to this. The people who had chosen to forcibly be dunked underwater rather than being forcefully thrown out of their home did not like the idea of having everything they owned thrown into the central collection. And all of them who opposed this were thrown inside of the city's church. After being locked in the church for hours, Mathis then entered surrounded by armed men. Mathis said that while they had committed a great sin, he would make an intercession to God on their behalf if they complied. And the people, fearing for their lives after being locked in the church, put 2 and 2 together and figured if I don't go along with what he's saying, the guy with the sword will probably kill me. So most of the people, fearing for their lives, went along with what Mathis was saying, assuming that they would be killed if they continued to protest. However, not everyone complied, and Mathis used this to set an example. One blacksmith not only refused to comply with Mathis's new way of life, but accused Mathis of being possessed. This blacksmith was stabbed with a halberd, dragged to the wall of the city, to which Mathis pulled out a gun and shot him in the stomach. The crowd watched in silence as the blacksmith bled out, and after he died, Mathis ordered everyone to sing a hymn. It was clear that anyone who opposed his rule would wind up just as the blacksmith had. Also, to call it a gun is a stretch. It was 1534, so it was one of those, like, giant matchlock pistols or whatever. A lot more dramatic than just casually shooting someone. On March 15th, Mathis ordered anything within the city that is a religious text that is not the Old or New Testament of the Bible was to be burned, further severing any connection to Christianity outside of the Bible, which Mathis was using to manipulate his own control. And it was around this time that Waldeck, the Prince Bishop of Munster, had had enough. Again, Waldeck didn't live within the city himself. He was over several cities within the region. While it seems in the early days of this, he just kind of let it play out. Like, the people have their own town council, and the town council is letting this guy preach his Anabaptist beliefs, whatever. But after seeing people get kicked out of the city, and then after everyone's stuff is being stolen, and after there's a public execution, which Waldeck didn't ordain, the Prince Bishop decided that he should probably do something other than let his city become like a Mad Max apocalypse. So Waldeck began building an army of mercenaries. Mercenary groups at the time were standing armies of soldiers that could be bought out by a family or a prince, or in this case, a prince bishop. And in this case, Waldeck was hiring these mercenaries in order to get his city back. So the mercenaries began to set up camps encircling Munster, and a siege began. Initially, the people of Munster were terrified of this, but the powers that be, in other words, Rothman, Nipperdoling, Mathis, and Van Leeden, manipulated this to their advantage. After all, they had said that God was coming back soon, and that this is where he would make his new Jerusalem. So it makes sense that the armies of the world would fight against the people of God, and not to worry, because they had God on their side. Nipperdoling specifically seemed to be quite instrumental in rallying the people together and preparing them for war. And prepare for war they did, as they effectively transformed Munster into a fortress state. Churches were transformed into armories, bell towers were repurposed as lookouts. Pots and pans were melted into munitions, weapon workshops operated day and night. Grain stores and food sources began to be rationed, and the entire population was under strict surveillance in look for dissenters. What had been marketed as a radical commune had now become a theocratic military dictatorship, manned by a group of people who not only believed that they could win, but that God told them they would. As a matter of fact, no one believed this as much as Mathis did. It's hard to tell from historical accounts how much of this was Mathis posturing to maintain his power, or how much of it was mental illness, probably a bit of both, at least. As at this point, Mathis claimed to be in constant communication with God. As he was talking to people, he would randomly stop, look up and listen, and then say what, according to him, God had just told him. And it was in one of these direct communications from God that Mathis said, on April the 5th, 1534, Easter Sunday, God would smite the enemy armies through a miracle. What was that miracle, you may ask? Well, Mathis said that himself, along with 30 hand-selected men, would ride out of the city and defeat the prince bishop and all of his armies by themselves. And that is exactly what he tried to do. On April the 5th, the gates of the city were opened, and Mathis, along with 30 men, charged the army of thousands of soldiers assembled by the prince bishop. Within moments, every single one of them were brutally slaughtered and beheaded. There was probably a moment of delay for the mercenaries to even realize what was going on, but as soon as they did, it wasn't fair. The prince bishop's armies slaughtered all 31 of them, beheaded them, and then placed Mathis's head on a pike outside of the city. Not only that, but they cut off Mathis's genitals and nailed them to the gate of the city that Mathis had just rode out of. Could you imagine, like, being Van Leeden or Rothman or one of the other people and being like, all right, God, go get him. And then, like, you shut the city gate and then you wait like 15 minutes and then you open it and that's just nailed there. And it's like, well, maybe next time. Now, it was at this point that a lot of people in Munster got worried. This Mathis guy who you've been following and done all of these absurd things that he's asked for just died, and he died a lot, very brutally. Supposedly, the prophet, who was in direct communication with God, didn't stand a chance, so why should the rest of you? And this probably would have been when panic set in and the city's union dissolved, if it wasn't for Van Leeden. Again, while Mathis was always stoic and authoritative, Van Leeden was always flamboyant and very passionate. Van Leeden said that since Mathis was dead, now Van Leeden was God's line of communication. And Van Leeden said that God told him Mathis had not been defeated by the approaching armies, but instead sacrificed himself so that they may definitely win. Just as an animal sacrifice from the Old Testament, Mathis knowingly threw his body to the enemy as a show of faith in God, and God would now reward their faith. Not only that, but Van Leeden declared himself the new David, and that he was to be the steward until Christ's return on earth. You know, you've got to give it to these guys, as awful as they were with, you know, the killing and whatnot, and it gets worse, trust me. But you got to give it to them, they can be quick on their feet. When they were in Strasbourg and their leader got arrested, immediately Mathis is like, ah, well, he was one of the two witnesses, and I am the other one. Let's go to this city. And as soon as Mathis again dies a lot, Van Leeden steps up and he's like, that was a coordinated sacrifice that, yes, we knew about this whole time. It's all part of the plan. So while the people in Munster begin their next plan of action, Prince Bishop Waldeck and his army began their plan of action as well. In May of 1534, Waldeck's armies had completely surrounded the city and were planning out their mode of attack. It was decided that the Archbishop's armies would assault his own city on dawn of May the 26th. This would be done by artillery softening the walls and gates of the city, allowing the foot soldiers to enter in and kill the opposition. Now, it's important to point out, while the Prince Bishop was a high-ranking member of the Catholic Church and can be assumed to be very religious and whatnot, the armies he had hired were not. Again, these were mercenaries. It wasn't uncommon for them to get paid by one family or kingship to fight in their wars, only for that king to get outbidded and then that same army fight against the people they were just fighting for. They were not here to secure the Catholic sanctity of Munster. They were there instead to kill a bunch of people and then loot and plunder everything in Munster. Because of that, on May 25th, the day before the attack was to take place, the armies got hammered. I mean, not an uncommon practice. If you know you're going to war tomorrow, might as well get drunk today. Well, it seems that one unit got a little too drunk on May the 25th and kept drinking from sunup to sundown. If you'll remember, the assault was set to begin on the sunrise of May the 26th. And it seems that one of the units was so drunk out of their mind that on May the 25th, someone saw the sun going down and was like, oh, we're supposed to fight now, right? And everyone else in the unit was like, oh, probably. So they just got their weapons and started screaming and charged the city. And every other unit who was witness to this saw them charging and said, oh, well, they must know that the assault's right now, even if it's supposed to be tomorrow morning, because why on else would they be doing that? So I guess the assault's right now, so they started charging too. Well, since the sun was going down, by the time they got to the wall of the city, it was dark. And there was no one to call off the attack because the prince, bishop, and the commanders were further behind lines resting for the assault that they thought was supposed to happen the next morning. So when the armies, now in total darkness, make their way to the gate of the city, there is no artillery to weaken the gate of the city. So now it's just hundreds of people pushing up against the walls and gates of this massive city in the middle of the night with no clue what they're supposed to be doing. And all of the people who were in Munster, who were ready for the bishop's armies to attack at any time, watched them scream and run all the way up to the wall of the city, and then in complete darkness scream and push against, again, the giant stone wall of the city. And assumedly, the Anabaptists go, oh, well, I guess that's my cue. The Anabaptists absolutely obliterated the invading army. With guns and bow, they rained down on any mercenary that was pushing up against the city wall. The women who weren't fighting used stones and mud to refill holes in the wall as soon as the invading armies could make a dent. Throughout the battle, Van Leeden rode from point to point in the city, assuring that the men were keeping up the defense. And the attackers never stood a chance. Since everyone was assumedly waiting till morning, they didn't have torches prepared. In the dead of night, it was easy for them to not know where the shooters on top of the wall were, but it was very easy for the people on top of the wall to figure out where the attackers were. And the bishop's armies were slaughtered. By the time daylight came, the prince bishop's armies had lost hundreds of men, while in Munster, less than 10 had died. And as you could imagine, immediately, the people of Munster had a huge celebration. Which, to their credit, if you watch the first leader die, and then the second leader says, oh, that was actually supposed to happen, and now God says we're definitely going to defeat the thousands of people lined outside of the city walls. And then that seemingly well-trained army attacks you in the dead of night, and you, a bunch of untrained peasants, slaughter all of them with less than 10 casualties. I can completely understand why this fueled a lot of the hype Van Leeden was pushing, at least for a time. You also have to know, regardless of how crazed he was or not, there was a part of Van Leeden that was like, I can't believe that worked. Rothman, still preaching and printing his messages, began to preach of how this failed siege was a miracle. And to add insult to injury for the Prince Bishop, Nipperdoling began to distribute these printings across Northern Europe. At the same time, outside of the city's wall, Waldeck saw all of this and said, okay, you want to play hardball? We're going to play hardball. Now electing, instead of attacking Munster, he can simply wait them out. I mean, think about it. All of the farms and means of production Munster has is in the countryside outside of the city wall. So eventually, they're going to run out of food. And Waldeck knows this and decides to wait. In the meantime, Van Leeden inside of the city decides to use this miraculous win as a way to double down. Van Leeden declared that not only was Munster going to be the location where God came to build his new Jerusalem, but that they were to prepare the city of Munster to be New Zion or New Jerusalem itself, and that Van Leeden himself was to be the king of earth until Jesus' return, effectively stating that they were no longer just preparing the location God would arrive, but building the kingdom of heaven itself, and that Van Leeden himself is a sort of God king. So in September of 1534, in Munster Central Square, Van Leeden held his own coronation. Dressed in golden embroidered robes, he crowned himself, took a golden scepter, and sat on a makeshift throne within the city circle. No longer a preacher or a prophet, but a monarch. He emblazed his new motto across the banners and shields of the men who now serve for him. The motto being, Gottes Macht ist mein Kraft, which is German for, God's power is my strength. Minecraft. Gottes Macht ist Minecraft. And the people applauded, believing Van Leeden to be a king that led them through one battle who would see them through the end of the war. It was at this point that any semblance of law or order within the city completely dissolved. Now Van Leeden's own private military, believing they were serving God himself, would enact laws that Van Leeden would come up with on a whim, stating them to be directly from God who was speaking into Van Leeden's ear. Even the council that was made up with of Anabaptist supporters was now replaced with people who simply followed Van Leeden's will. Effectively, Munster had become a cult compound. Van Leeden began to reprise the Ten Commandments, but they were followed with capital punishment. Things like theft, dissent, and adultery were punishable by death. Anyone found to be the slightest out of order of God's new will was publicly beaten and executed. In Essays in History, Volume 35, Tall Howard, while speaking on Munster, says the following. Finally, though Van Leeden maintained his grip on power through prophetic outbursts and appeals to scripture, his primary means of controlling the populace was terror and brute force. Two instances suffice to demonstrate this. The first one came in the wake of Van Leeden's decree of polygamy when a group of citizens, led by Henry Molenheck, attempted to stage a coup and depose him. Their efforts failed, however, and Molenheck, with 48 of his followers, was brutally tortured and ultimately beheaded in a macabre process that took 4 days. Afterwards, two mass graves were dug in the marketplace where all the dead bodies were placed, a solemn reminder of Van Leeden's authority. Indeed, the king would tolerate no transgressions. It was thus announced that all sinners in the future would be immediately brought before the king and sentenced to death. They would be extirpated from the chosen people, their very memory would be blotted out, and they would find no mercy beyond the grave. As mentioned in that quote, and as is common among cult leaders, polygamy was one of Van Leeden's first steps. And not only polygamy, but mandatory polygamy. He said that the city needed to repopulate the elect, or in other words, make a bunch of people who are followers of the true God or the true calling. And he modeled himself on the kings of ancient Israel who took dozens and hundreds of wives, especially the women who were widowed or orphaned during the mass executions and purgings of the city. Van Leeden himself took at least 16 wives, with one of them being Mathis's now widowed wife. Other things that women were known to be beheaded for was denying her husband his marital right, or in other words, a husband wanted to sleep with his wife, she said no, and she was executed. Another for bigamy, or in other words, having two male partners, because only men were allowed to have multiple female partners and not vice versa, so when a woman tried that, she was executed. And another was executed for insulting one of Van Leeden's preachers. In the midst of this, as Van Leeden's grip around the city tightened, so did the Prince Bishop's strategy. Food began to run out within the city and people got desperate. After they had eaten all of the standard animals to eat, like cows and pigs, they moved on to horses and then pet animals like dogs and cats. Eventually, they were eating rats and boiling shoe leather in order to make it soft enough to digest. All the while, Van Leeden would wear his silk robes and have banquets in the town square. Banquets which, of course, only his court were allowed to attend. And as he was well fed, he would preach to the people that their suffering was a sign of their faithfulness. That, of course, this is a sin-cursed earth, so their suffering means they must be following the one true God, and that they should view their suffering as a gift. Of course, easy to say, coming from the guy who's eating all of the food they can't have. At the same time this was happening, a sort of surveillance state began to be formed within Munster. Van Leeden had several within his ranks that would operate as secret police, listening for signs of dissent or small sins that were being committed in order to have people publicly humiliated and executed. This fueled paranoia and accusations became common. People would call out another for sins that they supposedly committed. And since the accuser had faith in Van Leeden, then whoever he accused was surely not following the one true God and was executed as well. By the time late autumn came around, Van Leeden had quit even referring to himself as a king and was just referring to himself in godlike terms. He was Christ's steward. He was David reborn. Everything short of calling himself the return of Christ himself. He even adopted Mathis's old practice of mid-conversation, stopping, looking up as if he was talking to God, nodding and whispering before saying what God had just told him. As more and more this new Jerusalem never came and the kingdom they were promised was instead suffering and starvation, Van Leeden would rewrite history and say that he wasn't wrong, instead he had simply misheard what God told him. And the reason for this mishearing was because he was bearing the weight of all of the sin of the people within Munster, and because of that weight he is sometimes burdened with sin and unable to have clear communication with God. And said that the people's salvation would be spiritual. They were already saved, and death, as they held out against the armies of the world, was their deliverance. At this point, it's kind of hard to see if the people believed him or simply believed they didn't have another choice. It is uncanny how many similarities there are between this story and Jonestown, down to an individual calling themselves a prophet of God and using messages of communalism to bring in the weak and the weary, using that to manipulate those people against the outside world and turn away detractors, eventually declaring themselves to be more of a prophet and to be an extension of God himself, using that to enforce polygamy and weird sexual practices and people turning on each other, and ultimately saying that to die in this position is to reach a true salvation. All the while, the Prince Bishop's plan was working. It was now winter, and the people inside were only getting hungrier and colder. One of the reasons that we know so much about what was happening within Munster at this time is thanks to someone named Herman von Kersenbrock. Kersenbrock was a chronicler and one of the people left within Munster during this takeover. He managed to keep his head down enough to stay out of Van Leeden's way and simply wrote down a lot of the things he saw. Among them during this time was the effects of the food shortage. As mentioned, people had already eaten their animals and were resorting to eating their shoes, but he witnessed several cases of people eating mice, slugs, and the grass that grew between pavement stones. They began to eat the bark off of trees and in one instance scraped the white lime paint from the churches, dissolved it in water, and then distributed it as milk. And of course, in their desperation for food, a lot of people were dead and those bodies made a horrific food source. Several of the mass graves were dug up and the rotting corpses consumed. If a child was stillborn, well, that was a source of food as well. And people began accusing each other of killing their own children in order to eat them. In a quote, Kersenbrock says, "The city was full of death everywhere. Large numbers of people collapsed on the street and suddenly died. To prevent a stench, their corpses were quickly heaved into a wagon specially prepared for this purpose at the king's command and carried away. They opened large graves for the burial of these corpses, and these were gradually filled up as bodies were cast into them." In an earlier message, Van Leeden had said that if they had faith, God would make the very paving stones they were walking on into bread. And in their delirium, people began to chew on the stones of the pavement itself. For those who realized the deception, it was all too late. Again from Kersenbrock, "Every place resounded with groans. Every place was filled with women's lamentations. Every place screeched with common's complaints, disturbed with the sobbing of the old and sick." Keep in mind that Van Leeden's feast continued through all of this. Several people decided that death was better than the suffering they were enduring. In large groups, they would open the gates of the city and walk towards the bishop's armies. As they approached, they were all gunned down. The Prince Bishop had no need for people who previously followed Van Leeden to become a part of the empire again. And several of them were beheaded and their heads put on stakes as a sign to those within the city what would happen if they tried to leave. But regardless or even hopeful of this outcome, people continued to try to leave time and time again, and time again were executed. Between April 22nd and June 15th, reports state that as many as 1,500 people chose to die this way. And those who didn't want to die were stuck starving within the city walls, watching all those who tried to leave lay dead before them. Some people within Munster became more strategic. Rather than simply walking across the field to be executed by the row of soldiers up front who were ordered to kill on sight, if people within Munster who wanted to defect could sneak out of the city another way and make their way to the back lines of the army, perhaps they could surrender. And some were able to do this and were interrogated by the Prince Bishop's forces. The Prince Bishop would isolate these defectors so that none could know the status of the other people they escaped with, and would be asked the same question to confirm their legitimacy. For example, each would be asked a password to a specific gate of the city because, again, in the earlier stages of this, Van Lieden was running the thing like the military, so there were secret codes to get in and out of gates. And if the Prince Bishop's men interrogated a group of people and they all said the same password, their word was trusted. According to several of the defectors, a rumor started to spread within Munster right before they left. The rumor was that within Van Lieden and his courts, they realized that the jig was up, and eventually they were going to run out of food and either die or the prince would come in and kill them all. And that Van Lieden had a plan to burn down the city if that were to occur. In other words, if I can't have it, then the Prince Bishop can't have it either. Now, the Prince Bishop's plan was to kill everyone within the city, but he still wanted the city when that was all said and done. So while he's okay with them starving to death, he is not okay with them burning to death. So the Prince Bishop changes his plan and decides to go onto another assault. Figuring out weak points in the wall, guard schedules, troop locations, he began to put together a strategy. On June 24th of 1535, the Prince Bishop selected 400 of his best soldiers, and at night, under the cover of a thunderstorm, sent them to invade the city covertly. The 400 men also took the defectors who had given them this information with them, not only to show them where the specific secret entrances were, but also in case their information was bad, it ensured that they died too. Under the cover of night and rain, they slipped into the city and began killing people in silence. Finding guards asleep and slitting their throats, coordinating to stab entire groups at once before they could give any alarm. Once the 400 men had killed the guards on the edge of the city, rather than opening up the gates and letting the rest of the army in, they kept pushing forward. And the 400 well-trained, well-fed soldiers, going up against the starving masses who had never been in a fight before, except for the one where the drunk guys ran up to the city several months ago, proved to be no match, and it was a slaughter, only this time in the other direction. Nipperdoling, one of Van Lieden's strongest supporters, was said to have rallied together a group of people in the marketplace that held off the 400 men for several hours, but were ultimately defeated. There was no quarter given to any men found within the city. Men who were found hiding under their beds or in their wardrobes were dragged out into the street and executed. The Prince Bishop had given two orders. Kill every man you find in the city, but leave the leaders alive. In the midst of the final stand in the marketplace, Nipperdoling disappeared. Until a few days later, when a woman who was hiding Nipperdoling gave up his location in exchange for her life. Bernard Rothman, the preacher whose sermon started this whole thing and continued to preach throughout the occupation, somehow escaped the city and was never seen again. There's different historic accounts of how Van Lieden was captured, but what we do know is that he was captured. Some accounts say he tried to run away and threw off his crown and robe in the process. Some say he fought like a madman and killed several of his own guards in the bloodshed. But regardless, he was captured, as was another one of his close confidants, a man named Bernard Crutching. That is the third Bernard in the story. So while all of the other men were dead, Van Lieden, Nipperdoling, and Crutching were captured alive. And 16 months after they first arrived in Munster, Van Lieden and his people were defeated. After the fall of the occupation, the Prince Bishop rode a coach drawn by six white horses into Munster. He stepped from the coach and now stood before Han Lieden, no longer in crowns and robes, but instead in chains and rags. The Prince Bishop said, "Bist du ein König?" To which Van Lieden replied, "Und bist du ein Bischof?" Which is German for, "Are you a king?" And Van Lieden replied, "And are you a bishop?" It's also worth mentioning that, especially at this time in the German language, du was meant to be an informal way to say the word are. So basically, it is the way you would say it to an inferior or someone who wasn't deserving of respect. So of course, when the Prince Bishop said, "Bist du ein König?" he is saying it mockingly to someone beneath him, But because Van Leeden replied, Un bistu ein Bischof, it is showing that he also feels that the bishop is inferior to him. Despite his rags and chains, it's still safe to say he probably assumes himself to be this sort of god king, even if deposed from his throne. Of the thousands of Anabaptists inside of Munster, very few of the men survived. I'm not sure how Kersenbrock survived. Perhaps he was one of the people who defected and told the Prince Bishop of how to attack the city. Perhaps he managed to hide during the slaughter and afterwards, when the Prince Bishop was making sure all of the Van Leeden supporters were dead, he realized Kersenbrock was not a supporter. But we know at least some of the men lived. It's also not just because the Prince Bishop now has control everything with Sunshine of Rainbows. They still executed a lot of people. Particularly, hundreds of women who were not killed in the initial battle because they weren't fighting, but nevertheless refused to resign their faith. Among them was the widow of Mathis, who Van Leeden later married. To ensure that this would never happen again, the Prince Bishop ordered that the walls of Munster be destroyed, assuring that he would never have to go to war against his own city again. For several months, Van Leeden and his surviving lieutenants were paraded throughout the Holy Roman Empire, through courtrooms and public places, sometimes interrogated, but most of the time humiliated. They were dragged through the empire as a warning to those who go against the church and also, you know, do things like mass murder that isn't ordained by the church. It seemed that Van Leeden tried to argue for his life, seeing what his final destination on this tour journey would be. It said that he suggested to the Prince Bishop that he should be kept alive as long as possible in order to serve as a testament of what happens to those who go against the Prince Bishop and, you know, the Catholic Church. The Prince Bishop denied this offer because he had a better idea of how to use Van Leeden to dissuade any future rebellion. And that's what takes us to the morning of January the 22nd, 1536. Back in Munster, just outside of Nipperdoling's former home, several wagons were tied together and planks laid across the top of them as a sort of crude stage. On top of the platform was a vertical stake, and lower on the platform was a smaller horizontal bar in order to chain the arms behind the person. Next to the stakes were three charcoal pits, and inside of the pits, along with the white-hot charcoal, were iron tongs. And next to the stage were three empty iron cages. What I am about to describe is like one of the top five worst execution methods I think I've ever heard. I understand there's a lot of bad ones out there. There's like the brazen bull and the boats and keel hauling. I get that, but this one makes me squirm. So again, viewer discretion advised if that wasn't apparent enough at this point in the video, but you're this far in. You're not going to quit watching now. At 8 a.m., the city gates were locked and the people of the town amassed in the courtyard outside of Nipperdoling's window. On the second story balcony of Nipperdoling's house, the Prince Bishop sat in order to get a better view. Van Leeden, Nipperdoling, and Kretching were led to the top of the platform. It is said that upon seeing the glowing togs, Nipperdoling was struck dumb with absolute terror. Kretching remained silent and resigned, and Van Leeden dropped to his knees and begged for forgiveness. Just as I'm sure many dropped to their knees and begged him for mercy when he controlled the city he was now standing in. But in both cases, mercy never came. A representative of the Holy Roman Empire stepped forward and read the men's charges, which have been recorded by Hermann von Kersenbrock. Quote, "He sinned against God and ruler. He revived the errors of the Anabaptists condemned by councils and law. He polluted sacraments, plundered churches, profaned sacred things. He stirred sedition, cast down the lawful ruler, and made himself king by personal authority. He committed treason, expelled citizens, and stripped them of property." The three men were shackled upright to the stakes by iron collars that were surrounded in spikes. The spikes around the collar were to prevent too much movement or an attempt at changing position. The men were placed with their backs facing the person who was to be tortured before them. So in other words, they could hear and smell everything that was about to happen, but couldn't see it. And Van Leeden was the first on the chopping block. So two executioners came up to Van Leeden, and they took the tongs that were glowing red and he's tied like this, right? They reach up into his armpits, like, and grab a bunch of like the muscle and tissue, and they pinch down, and the tongs are so hot it just burns through the skin and wraps around pieces of flesh, and they rip them out. And they proceeded to do that in every crevice and corner of his entire body. Normally, these injuries would cause someone to bleed out, but the tongs were so hot that it essentially cauterized all the wounds they were creating. Now, you couldn't live for a long time like this, but they didn't need a long time, just an hour. As a matter of fact, precisely an hour. The execution order was that they were to be pulled apart with red-hot tongs for an hour straight, and if at any point they were to pass out or seize up, they were to be revived, and the timer started again. Done in such a methodical way, grabbing ribs or underneath the ribs or the crevice in the knee or all the fleshy parts that hang off your body. Done in such a way to make sure that the executioner got an hour of torment before death was to come. The searing not only caused immense pain, but the burning flesh could be smelled by everyone on the platform, especially the other two who were awaiting their execution. According to Kersenbrock, the tongs were so hot that the moment it would touch skin, the skin would burst into flame. Quite literally, pulled apart piece by piece. Muscles stripped from bone, tendons shredded and pulled. Everywhere that the tongs touched, the skin became a deep black. Despite the agony, according to reports, Van Leeden barely screamed, more than likely because of shock. At the end of the torment, the executioners pulled out his tongue, ripped out his throat, and then finally plunged a knife into his heart. As his corpse sagged on the stake, smoldering and smelling, it was then Nipperdoling's turn. Nipperdoling, and undoubtedly the smartest move he's done in this entire story, tried to kill himself. He leaned all the way forward onto the spiked collar to try to choke himself to death. But of course, the executioner wasn't going to let that happen. They tied a band across his mouth to the back of the pole, ensuring he couldn't try it again. And then he received his hour of execution, and after him, Crutching the same. When it was over, the three bodies were cut down and shoved into the three iron cages. The cages were then hung up at the top of the St. Lambert's Church in Munster. The same church that Van Leeden and his people took over a year prior now hosted the bodies of him, two of his followers. And this may be the craziest part of the story. This blew my mind. Those cages are still hanging on St. Lambert's Church to this day. The bodies have been removed, but they put the cages back up. So if you go to Munster right now and go to the church, St. Lambert's Church, in the town center, you can see the three cages that the three tormented bodies were shoved into, still right up there just as they were in 1535. Or 1536, whatever, I'm tired, and this is insane. That is one of the coolest things Europe has ever done. I know for a fact if this happened in the United States, they would cut those down because, I don't know, it's offensive or whatever. But no, like, if those guys were hanging up there, I want to see the cages. I get taking the bodies down, that would be a lot, especially for, you know, young children and tourists or whatever, but they left those cages up, and I respect that. After all of this was over, Munster served as a footnote for what zealot religion can do. Figures like Martin Luther condemned what happened at Munster, and even members within the Anabaptist movement denounced it and continued to preach pacifism as one of their core tenets. The word Munster became synonymous with fanaticism, heresy, and coming apocalypse. And today, it serves as a prototype for a lot of things we've seen out of cults in the centuries that have followed. It feels tragic that so many people came to Munster because they were poor, because they were hungry, and thought there was a better life awaiting them, and when they saw people who they assumed to be more educated than themselves tell them that this is what God wants for them, they followed along because what else could they do? And it's tragic that so many of them paid the price. But at the same time, the absurdity of this borders on hilarity. You had like a cult leader go to a town, and then he gets horrifically killed trying to go out and fight the invading army, so the new guy shows up and he gets killed even worse, which it's like one of the most brutal execution methods ever, and it somehow happened to the one guy that was probably a fitting death for. It is an insane story that the moment I saw it, I had to talk about it, and hopefully you enjoyed hearing about it, and if you did, that's really cool, and I appreciate it, and I want to say you're really cool, and I also want to say thank you for watching. Like I said, Vincent brought this up and put together a document on it, and I was like, yeah, I need that. this is too weird to not talk about. So thank you, Vincent, for that. This video wouldn't be possible or known without you. This is one of the craziest stories I've ever read, and I think it's great, and hopefully you guys enjoyed it. Be sure to show Vincent some love in the comments, and be sure to check out what we're doing over on Windigang if you're interested, because he's done a couple other scripts for me at this point that are really cool, and that guy's great, and all of my researchers are great. The whole team's awesome. I'm very blessed to be working with these guys. It means a lot. People far more educated and better at this than myself. I think it was Andrew Carnegie who had the quote, "I have made my success by surrounding myself with people far better than I," or something like that. And I stick by that motto because I have no idea what I'm doing, but these people do somehow, and I appreciate them. So very thankful for all of them. If you want to see what we're doing, check out Windigang. Link will be in the description as always. But yeah, this is just such a wild story, and I had to talk about it. So I hope that you guys enjoyed. I'm really thankful. There's been so many things happening with me, like just making weird videos or me starting new projects and you guys being supportive of it. And like the nonprofit going great and all these opportunities I've been getting to meet with some people who like make art that I'm really passionate about. So just you, I'm in my feelings. You guys are awesome for allowing me this position in life. It means the world, and thank you for it. So I'm going to send this over to the editor so that hopefully you guys can see it sooner rather than later. And I believe that should do it for now. And oh well, of course, thank you Caitlin, the editor, love you lots always, but I believe that should do it for now. But I just want to say thank you for watching, hope that you enjoyed, and I will see you in the next one. Bye.